You're listening to The Zeitcast, a podcast with Jonathan Martin that aims to speak to the spirit of the moment we're in. Thank you for joining us today. Friends, Joel here. It is great to be back with you for another episode. On the Zeitcast today, we're sharing a conversation that Jonathan had with Cindy Wong Brandt. Cindy is an author, podcaster, and speaker on progressive faith and its related issues. She's the founder of a popular Facebook group, Raising Children Unfundamentalist, which offers practical advice and encouragement to parents. This group started as Christian parents who are committed to raising their kids in a faith that isn't hierarchical, controlling, and fundamentalist. It is comprised of parents who want to see their children desire mercy and not sacrifice, to grow up walking in the ways of Jesus for peace, righteousness, and wholeness. In today's episode, Jonathan's discussion with Cindy focuses around her book, Parenting Forward, How to Raise Children with Justice, Mercy, and Kindness, particularly in an age where fundamentalism seems to be on the rise, if not in vogue. They discuss finding hope within the current political landscape and get into practical, real-life examples of how we raise our children, our families, and our culture around a more loving, merciful, inclusive, gracious reality. Friends, welcome to another episode of The Zeitcast.
Well, welcome back to the Zeitcast, everybody. I am so pleased today to have Cindy Wong Brandt on the show for the first time. She has written a book that has become very important for me in this phase of my life. And so I definitely want to talk about Parenting Forward, How to Raise Children with Justice, Mercy, and Kindness. So much happening in the world. And Cindy's actually talking to me from Taiwan right now. It's just such a gift to be able to have this time with you. So, Cindy, welcome to the Zeitcast. Such a thrill to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad that we got to meet in person a few years ago, and it's really good to chat with you again.
Yes, I guess that was at the first Evolving Faith?
Yeah.
Oh, it was such a sweet time.
I know.
Really, really beautiful time.
Really special, yeah.
So we were just talking a little bit about kind of how you're surviving things. I mean, I know you guys are quite ahead of us there, so I'm glad to hear that you guys are, I mean, y'all are navigating virus stuff especially well. So
yes.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, we really did get very lucky. I feel like, it just really was lucky because we had this, our vice president is an epidemiologist, graduated from Johns Hopkins, and who could have known that?
Wow.
That it was just for such a time as this. And so I'm really grateful for our safety here, but I try to really do my part to share the experiences of what it's like to be able to be out safely So I talk about masks a whole lot, you know, to just try to help people. A pandemic is a worldwide crisis. And so as much as it's a crisis, it also draws us together. And so I hope that, I want to help out my fellow brothers and sisters around the world with whatever resources that I can offer.
Yeah. I'm still hung up for a moment, Cindy, just trying to metabolize this idea about people in government who not only value expertise, but are experts themselves. I can't quite imagine this strange alternate reality of which you speak. I'm like, where is this magical place?
I'll say this, though. The American people have shown so much resilience. And, you know, when Trump was elected, I was like, there was an article out by Viet Thanh Nguyen, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning novelist. And he wrote a piece that said, "I believe in the people over the president." And mm-hmm. that stuck with me for the past 3 years. And I tried to see how resilient people are and individuals and just grassroots movements. And there's really a lot of hope. I know it's hard to see at times on Twitter.
yes, for sure. For sure. So true. So true. But no, I have seen a lot of resilience. There are a lot of things that that do make me feel hopeful. And I mean, I know like you, certainly in a lot of conversation right now with people who are in a lot of philosophical, spiritual shift. And that's one of the things I love so much about your work, of course, is I feel like it's just such a wonderfully particular niche. That people who are in the midst of their own kind of faith transition and then scrambling, like I think a lot of us are, to figure out how to navigate that with children and with families. I do want to talk about your book, and I'll say more in a minute about why that's so helpful for me right now. But I thought maybe it'd be a good place to start because, you know, even in your book, you reference Krista Tippett's kind of famous interview question when you're kind of setting up your own story in terms of kind of your earliest memory of childhood spirituality. So especially, I guess, in a conversation where we'll talk about your own approach and philosophy to parenting, I'd love to ask you a bit about that in terms of just your earliest memories of faith and God and your own spiritual formation.
Yeah, so good. It does reveal so much about who we are when we talk about childhood spiritual imagination. So I am one of those people, those kids who thought about death from as long as I can remember. And that was also laced with a lot of anxiety, but it also meant that I cared a whole lot about sort of the deeper meanings of what it means to be human. So I did think about death a lot. I read, and I grew up in Taiwan, so I grew up reading kind of Chinese mythology books, and there were lots of really interesting stories about the afterlife. There's the idea of reincarnation. There's these folk religious stories of people who find eternal life potions and cures, and I just was so fascinated by all of that. But when I was about middle school, 10, 12 years old, my parents sent me to a school that was started by Christian missionaries in Taiwan. And so the ethos of that school is very much what you would see as conservative evangelicalism in America. And of course, it's the same people who came over here to evangelize to my people. So I was converted there. And I was really an easy catch because mm-hmm. of, like I referenced, my death anxiety. So you tell an anxious child that there's this prayer that you can pray and it will ensure eternal life in the arms of a loving God. And it really was not hard for me to make that decision. Unfortunately, it took me into a world and a community and a way of thinking that ended up being very harmful for me. Someone just asked me actually if that assuaged my death anxiety. And I think at the time I would have said yes, but in hindsight, it really didn't. It made me probably even more anxious, witnessed by the fact that I prayed the prayer over and over again. If I had felt secure in that one prayer why did I pray it over and over again? And this is a common story. I know lots of people who have the same experience. And so there was something limited and shallow about the evangelical message that did not sink in, that did not give me the kind of unconditional love that maybe I was craving. And so that's kind of my, the spirituality of my childhood. This anxiety ridden, I mean, I was also full of joy and imagination. I think a lot of anxious kids are imaginative. That's why we can imagine the worst case scenarios. And so it was kind of a mixture of both of that. And then the second half of my childhood, my adolescence and formation was very much in the conservative evangelical ethos. And then my adulthood and till now has sort of been a deconstructing of that, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, has become a movement that's kind of popularized. So, my work now is to try to help families who have similar stories to me of this faith shift, try to navigate raising kids, because again, it kind of throws you back into that childhood. And sometimes it's triggering of your own spiritual trauma. And what does it mean to raise kids with more autonomy, and so that they don't have to unlearn some of the painful things that we learn. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not to just nod my head, Cindy, because I know just because the way you talk about your own story, you have to hear this all the time. But it's interesting just how many things is how I like, while coming from a different culture, like at every point I nod my head, but everything from like a fixation on death that I do kind of think I might have had regardless, because like I know in my world, it kind of converged at the same time I saw the 70s tribulation Antichrist movies that terrified me. There also was a little movie that we saw in my little AG class at school about Nostradamus. I think I was just in every direction, I was preoccupied with death and all these heavy things. So I think I probably would have been that way regardless. But then you put you come alongside that with all the kind of fire and brimstone rapture stuff. And I mean, it was panic attacks. It just kind of ate me alive. And I mean, that even after my theology shifted, you know, all that was so kind of in my marrow. But at the same time, I think like I also was highly imaginative, which I can see as kind of the flip side of the anxiety. You know, I think sometimes when I look back at that, though, I kind of think if a kid's more kind of emotionally intuitive, of course you're going to take these things seriously, because, you know, if that's your view of the world and that's really the way things are going to play out, isn't it actually more normal to go around obsessed with these things? Like, shouldn't everybody, you know? I actually think like if you're kind of emotionally adjusted, that would be a pretty proper kind of response.
Yeah. I try to, some of the things I talk about in my work is that I don't believe children are people that are spiritual blank slates that you have to fill with theological doctrines, that they are spiritual agents from the moment we're born. And so I think a lot of these thoughts about death and about life, because really thinking about death is thinking about life, right?
Yeah.
And even very, very young kids, I know I did think about death. And why is that? And for me, it's proving my narrative that kids are spiritual. They are actively engaging in the meaning and the deeper things of life, you know, from as young as we know. And so I think this idea that, oh, we have to teach them is really wrong. It's the wrong posture to take for adults. And I would love to see people to view children in a different light, that they are active agents of their own.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, Cindy. Oh, that's so good. Now, just to, in terms of back to your own journey for just a second. So you, when you hit your kind of deconstruction phase, roughly at what point in your life was that for you?
I have one of those stories that is very gradual and long. And I think this is true for, I would dare say it's true for everybody, because I think deconstruction takes as long sometimes as the formation of your faith in the first place. And because my faith was formed throughout my childhood at such an impressionable time, it really took decades for me to slowly figure things out. I know the word deconstruction can be a little bit loaded, but sure. really it's just figuring stuff out, right? And I had a few sort of critical incidents in my life where one would be when my brother came out as trans in around 2009. So that was kind of a shakeup, kind of jolts you out of the status quo, because all of a sudden we have to contend with kind of a hostile community in the Christian community. But I would say that's the more dramatic incident. Everything else has been more like, you know, I'm a woman of color. I am Asian and a woman. And that's also a hostile environment in many ways.
Yeah.
And just unpacking the ways that I've internalized some of the sexism with inherent in the theology and just a lack of representation of my voice and my experience. All of that, you know, is has been part of my deconstruction journey and trying to find a place to reclaim my power and just my story, just being able to exist as fully as who I am, which is also the goal that I have for parents, to let their kids really be truly who they are.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, Cindy, what stream of evangelicalism was that for you?
You mean the one I grew up with?
Yeah, that you grew up in, uh-huh.
I don't know, because it was really, whoever sends out missionaries.
Okay, gotcha. Gotcha.
Okay. We really had, let's see, the school that I went to was founded by four major denominations,
okay.
which was like Southern Baptist and, oh goodness, I don't know if I can name them all, but like they would say they're non-denominational. So like the equivalent of like a non-denominational mega church, like that's the strain. Mm. So I'm not too familiar. We did have, I know you're Pentecostal from that tradition. So we did have Pentecostals as well. But we had the really conservative kind, I think.
Sure.
With the long skirts and...
As many folks within the tradition are, I love that you emphasize sort of just the long game that kind of deconstruction process is, because I can think of so many examples of like ways in which my mind change and my theology change, but still, I mean, like, you know, I mean, long after I stopped believing in some of the things that I used to in terms of some of the, I don't know, eternal conscious torment and rapture kind of stuff. I still had dreams about it probably into my late 20s, you know? Yeah. And I mean, like, that's pretty long after, you know, some of the shifts of the way you kind of carry those things around. Now, was that, I think for a lot of the folks that I talk to even now, especially early in that journey, there's a certain amount of terror that comes with asking some of those kind of questions and feeling like you may be on kind of the wrong side of the tradition, on the wrong side of God. Was there terror in that for you, or did you have some people around you who were supporting you when you first started to ask some of those critical questions?
You know, like so many other people, is Rachel Held Evans.
Oh wow.
You know, people, the bloggers in the late 2000s who emerged, that made me feel like, oh, maybe it's okay to talk about these things publicly. Right. But then it was also when I began to talk about it publicly, the pushback that I got made me feel like, well, why? How come we can't even talk about it? How come we can't even be honest? And that kind of accelerated the deconstruction even more, because I felt like, well, how can I trust in a system that won't even let me be true? Yeah. So it's, you know, some people ask me, in a way I publicly deconstructed, in a way I wrote my way to deconstruction. And so it's a mixture of lots of things, right? But I totally relate to you saying that you were still having, you know, nightmares. I think that, and the more that I learn about sort of trauma and the way our brain is wired, it's like our brains were wired to be a certain way. And yeah, you can change your mind and your theology, and you can even, you know, change your physical location and, you know, stop going to church or whatever, but brain. It's kind of still is lodged in there.
Yes.
And I think that, I really think being honest about that is a huge step, just to be aware and to know that this is something that you will be wrestling with. I feel like it takes a little bit of the pressure off, because sometimes we, want to say, why are you, we're so hard on ourselves, right? We're like, why are you still having these, why haven't you healed yet? I mean, imagine saying that to someone else who's hurting, right? And yet we say it to ourselves.
Oh, so true. So true. That's, that's so helpful, Cindy. It really is. And, I don't know. I'm just thinking about how, because I know that a lot of phases of the journey, I've not been gracious with myself. I know a lot of people I know are not. And I'm thinking too, just kind of pivoting a little bit in terms of what you're doing now, about how, even as we talk about our own stories and our own journeys thus far, how much it kind of pulls out of you. Because of course, and I told you I would say a bit about why the book matters so much to me right now. I mean, I don't have children biologically, but now being a divorced person who's now in a long-term relationship with these four kids in my life now that I adore, it's really interesting the things that stirs up in me, because it's like, you know, there's this stuff that you have kind of worked through theologically for yourself, but, you know, I still had these certain kinds of containers in terms of like how I grew up. And now that I'm thinking on a whole different level than I've had to before about how to, about the spiritual formation of these kids, man, it's just really interesting the thing that stirs up, because I think part of what, of what you come to see is like when fear has been so much of the engine of like your own formation, even though in so many ways I've kind of put that, I feel like I put so much behind, but now it's like, okay, so when you do have not a blank slate, but you do have the opportunity now with kids where hopefully they're not going to have to go down that road, but if it's not going to be based in fear and you don't necessarily know what it's like to grow up in a theological system where there isn't that sense of threat, you know, what does that really look like? I mean, wow, yeah. it really pulls up a lot of stuff.
I think that a lot of the fear that was instilled in us was a way of control. It was a way that the authorities in our lives wanted to control our behavior. And that's not, it's not healthy, but it's also understandable. Because now you are this figure in these children's lives and you kind of want to control them because you love them and you want them to be safe. Mm-hmm. And so you go to the one thing that you know to best control, which is fear. And so, but yet you still, you know that, oh, that was damaging for you. You don't want that. So what do you do? I think that's really common. I try to be empathetic to parents who are afraid, because fear is also love, right? It's not. So I love Elizabeth Gilbert's illustration where she says, we tell fear to sit in the back seat, that fear doesn't get to drive, but we're not violent towards our fear. We say, I see you. Thank you for doing what you're trying to do to help protect me and my family, but you sit in the back seat and I'll do the driving. So I love that.
That's
great. I feel like, with our kids. So one of the things that I really, really deconstructed, especially when I started working with parenting, is this idea of the original sin. I don't know if that's going to get me in trouble with put me on the hot heretical seat, but I really believe people are good. I don't believe that people are inherently sinful. And so with that perspective in mind, how much do you trust your children? How much do you trust that they are good, that they want to do good, that they want to be good? And the support that you give them helps them so that they can be that person that they know they are and want to be. And that's, to me, it's hard. It really is hard, because you have to trust in this person and you don't get to control them. And that's hard for us.
Mm-hmm. It really is. Right?
Yeah.
It's like that difference from parenting from Genesis 1 versus Genesis 3 makes all the difference in the world, doesn't it? I mean, two very different foundations of whether or not we're starting in creation and original goodness, or this whole, or these notions of fall and depravity. And man, it's, what do you, Sydney, what about for people for whom, like, because I feel like these are a lot of the folks, you know, we have this fledgling little faith community in Oklahoma City. We started a year ago. Like, so many people in our community who are parents are pretty new on this kind of deconstruction journey. And, you know, so what do you do, like, when you're still kind of in the throes of that kind of process yourself? And that still might be new. I mean, I know a lot of people who are in their 20s and 30s, you know, who haven't been on this journey for 5 years or 10 years. It might be more like, you know, 6 months, 2 years, 3 years or whatever, but trying to figure out now, trying to get handles around how to approach parenting when their own faith is just in complete upheaval. What does that look like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say that you're not alone, that it's happening every day, that people are going on this path of rethinking their faith. And I think it's really important to validate parents' feelings and the turmoil that you feel, because it is really, really confusing. And it's what started me thinking about these things and writing about it, eventually turning into a book. Because I just felt like, I'm so confused. I don't know what to do. I'm rethinking my faith, and I'm supposed to be raising these kids at their most impressionable time. This is not a possible task. And so I started by just trying to find people and know that I'm not alone, which I did. And so I want to offer that to people who are new to this journey, that you aren't alone, that all your feelings are valid, which is, you know, exactly the lesson you want to give your kids as well, that their feelings are valid. And give yourself time to figure things out. And our kids are resilient, and they appreciate honesty more than theological correctness. And they care about your presence more than the answers that you can give them. So just hold your kids tight through the storm that you're in, and be as honest as you can, and stay together, stay present, and be with them, and show them what it's like to go through a struggle. I feel like that's one of the best things. I mean, now that we're in this pandemic, we're learning the same lesson, right? The best way to weather a crisis is together. So, be gentle with yourself.
That's so good, Cindy. And I feel like I've seen, like, I mean, that's enough, like, Nicole's model a lot and getting into her journey in terms of just being very transparent with the kids, and the sense of kind of going on a journey together. And I don't know, just this way of inviting them in a way that doesn't freak them out or doesn't make them feel like, you know, the wheels are coming off or something. But there is the sense of being very, I don't know, of being vulnerable in appropriate ways, I think, about some of those shifts.
Let me say, sorry, this is important. I want to make sure. It is really important when you are going through faith deconstruction that you have a support group that's maybe other adults, because yes, as important as it is to be vulnerable with your kids, you don't want them to feel like they're responsible for your, for all the baggage that you have. So yeah, be sure to find a support group that's maybe other adults. And then when you feel like you can, then you can tell them this. You can say, hey, listen, I have people who are helping me, but I also want you to know that I'm going through this hard thing. And I also want to say that for people who are new to deconstruction or faith shifting, a lot of times as you deconstruct and you change your minds, you'll often feel a lot of guilt for the things that you taught your kids earlier before you changed your mind. And that's really common as well. And I just have to say that children want to forgive you. So it's never too late to ask for forgiveness and to say that you were wrong. I think that's just being honest, and I think your kids will appreciate that.
This podcast is brought to you by the generosity of our patrons. Please consider supporting the show. The Zeitcast with Jonathan Martin. We'll be right back.
Well, one of the many things I wanted to ask you about in particular, in terms of some of the categories kind of beneath all of this, is, you deal with this beautifully in the book, but I'm sure it has to be a primary topic, I would think, that you're asked about a lot. I feel like sexuality in particular is especially complex, because think on the one hand, I think for those of us who have been on this kind of a journey, there's certainly a sense, and we could go more into that if you'd like, but there's certainly like this sense that, like, okay, we've seen what's unhealthy about purity culture and what's unhealthy about shame and shaming. But then on the other hand, also seeing in a world where there's so much exploitation and commodification and all of that. So I definitely feel like I'm having a lot of those kind of conversations right now with parents too, who are trying to navigate that kind of space, as Gabe was saying, like, okay, we know that purity culture with all the corresponding shame is not where we want to go, but also knowing that there are a lot of dangerous messages. I think specifically again, kind of the commodification that come around, the porn industry and like all that. So we definitely don't want to like leave our kids out there to just like, okay, go figure this out on your own. So what would you say to parents who are struggling to kind of figure out how to discern how to have those kind of conversations faithfully?
I think it's really important to have healthy sex ed. I think information is power here. I think that we need to give our kids good facts and healthy sexual messages, and that will equip them to know how to navigate the kind of sexual ethic that they want. Because it's messy. And I think part of what makes the conversation so messy is because every individual is different. We're learning about sort of the identity, the gender identity and orientation spectrum. We're learning about different kinds of sexuality, from asexual to demisexual to polyamorous or whatever. There's all these different ways of approaching it. And so I think that's what makes it difficult to talk about, because everyone has different contexts. And but what I believe in with the parenting space is that we equip our kids with the information that they need to know, so that they can have the tools to investigate it themselves. But growing up with purity culture is a real, it's a real shit show. Can I say that?
Yes, you can. You're absolutely allowed to say that.
Okay. It's real. I mean, talk about taking time to untangle it, right? Yeah. Yeah. Talk about, you can change your mind and say that, oh, for instance, pleasure and desire is good and holy. Yeah. You can believe that all the day long, but that shame will still haunt you. Mm-hmm. I just want to say you're not alone, and to just be in solidarity with people who are going through it, because it just takes time. And no matter how much I or anyone else try to tell you you are good, your desire is good, that it might still take you time to believe it in your soul and in your body. And that's really hard. It's a hard space to be parenting from. But it could also be an opportunity for healing. It could be an opportunity to learn, okay, what would it look like if I had just been given, the correct anatomical names for my body parts, if I am told that my desire is good and not shameful, and I'm told that I can have control over my sexuality and that I get to be sexual, what does that look like? And that can also really be healing, because you realize that you parent the child in you at the same time.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Cindy, how I've just been thinking a lot even about conversations I've had with close friends lately, how we've what a common thread it's been, how if you kind of grow up within purity culture, just the irony of, because, I keep thinking about this verse and not going Sunday school on it, but this verse in 1 John of, if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with each other, and the blood of Jesus cleanses from sin and all this. But this idea of walking in light, which I think really is all about walking in exposure and just walking in authenticity. It's like I just think at every turn, for most people I know, it's like all of the most authentically self-destructive choices that most of us are ever make come out of a place of shame. And it's just the ultimate irony to me about like purity culture is that it produces the exact opposite of what people seem to intend. Because I've seen over and over again that like when people are trusted and they're loved and they're given information and there's not all the stigma that people are able to flourish and thrive and like be healthy. But it's precisely that when you have a culture that produces hiding and produces all this kind of inner schism and cutting things off or whatever, that's what really, you know, produces all the kind of self-destructive stuff. So, yeah.
I think it's there are these boxes that we've created to confine the human experience. And when it doesn't fit, then anything outside of the box, we try to hide. And then it really twists our insides. It twists our human experience to something extremely toxic and unhealthy. So, you know, I think we have to let human beings be human beings and not try to contain that. It's to not be afraid of a little bit of wild all of us. And
Oh, it's so
I really recommend the book, The Good Christian Sex by Bromley McLennan. So if anyone wants a good theological treatment of healthy sexuality, that's the book I'd recommend.
Yeah, great, great. I'll definitely check that out too. Kind of maybe in the same spirit of kind of talking about how we process things, get some, you know, sexuality. I know one of the things we've been talking about even today, because you know, it has been another really heavy day, like in America. I mean, I feel like, you know, on what day is there not something really heavy that happens in the news? But today, I don't know, it's like, at least within our little family context, I mean, Nicole was literally sitting down with Alexa, who's 9. And the whole reason they were kind of sitting down at the computer was they were going to talk about that whole this whole video that came out about with Amy Cooper and this whole, you know, which I mean, it was terrible, but it felt like it was going to be kind of a teachable moment. This is the person who, you know, calls the cop on a black man who very politely asks her to, you know, put a leash on the dog. And so they're going to have it. And it's right when they sit down with this that, you know, all of a sudden her phone is blowing up with what I would call the murder, kind of public execution of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And, you know, so it kind of turns into this whole other thing. And one of the things I know we're processing a lot is like this sense that on the one hand, I think especially with our technology, it does open up access to information that's important. And we want to have conversations about things that matter, but also thinking about what's developmentally appropriate and all those kinds of things, because, you know, we definitely don't want to shield, definitely don't want to do the kind of like heads in the ground thing, but also at the same time, you know, so especially like in a world right now with that kind of access from technology, I just love you to speak a bit to that, is what those conversations look like when there's just a lot of raw stuff out there that we know that we need to deal with, but how we process that with kids in a way that's responsible developmentally.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that I think we need to disrupt is this idea that children are fundamentally different than we are. Because we've really set up, like I said, these boxes we have set up to confine the human experience. We've set up a box for adults and a box for children. And that's not necessarily true. There are some differences, obviously, but there are also a lot that's the same. And I think a lot of times we don't see that because we're so stuck in our boxes. What's healthy for a child in terms of media consumption is what's healthy for us because they're humans just like we are. And I think that sometimes it is too much when we know it. That's why we log off of the internet. And I don't know, it seems like the wisest teachers that I am learning from know to limit their time in the news, because it really gets to a point where it's unproductive and unhelpful to have that much input when we need time and energy to process it and you know, and steep in sort of the, to be able to hear, you know, our inner voice and hear the voices of wise people. So yeah, I think having a healthy balance for your kids is really wise. But at the same time, of course, I'm also very passionate about raising anti-racist kids. And I have a whole chapter in my book about that. But see, one of the things I love about working with parents is that it's the long game. And I think justice is the long game. And so I think that parents know this intuitively, because we know we can teach our kid one thing and it's years and years before we'll see the fruit of that. And I think that's a good mindset to have going into doing justice work, mm-hmm. because it's the same thing. You can talk about this one thing and it'll be years before we'll see some progress and change. And so I think with anything heavy and huge and systemic like racism, it's really important to scaffold our conversations with our kids. So one of the worst things that you can do is to be silent. The white silence is deadly. If we want to deal with the problem of white silence, we can't be silent. White families can't be silent with their kids. And so it's important to have these conversations. But again, I would also say, make sure that you have other adults who are helping you process these things before you have these conversations with your kids, because a lot of times our anxieties spill over. And there's a difference between being honest and vulnerable with your kids, like we talked about earlier, and sort of dumping our anxiety on them, right? Mm-hmm. So similarly, I would encourage parents to find places to process and then have these intentional conversations with your kids specifically to combat white silence, so that they are used to talking about race. They're used to talking about even police brutality. Because we know kids so young are navigating race, right? There's kids who from third grade and they're playing ball and they separate into blacks and whites, that the teams are like that. Right. And in early adolescence and in teenager years, they're already navigating so many race dynamics. And so to give them that gift of the ability to make something that is invisible visible, to talk about it, to navigate it, to build meaningful relationships with people of another color, that is the best gift that you can give to your kid. And that doesn't just happen automatically. And this is what you mentioned, the Twitter thread that I had written the other day.
Yes.
I'm trying to say, so many people just think that it's just going to happen. Like, oh, when they're ready, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about this really hard thing when they're ready. Well, they're not going to be ready unless you have been talking about it from as soon as they have words,
right?
You know? So talk about it, and it can be really simple. I think a lot of parents are intimidated because they don't know what to say. It doesn't have to be super complicated, especially when your kids are little, but notice color. Don't do this colorblind thing. Say, yeah, this person, and kids will say it. They'll point out color because they see it. Kids are not colorblind. And when they do, don't be afraid to say, okay, yeah, let's talk about this person's color. And what our skin color is, what does that mean in the world? How are we treated differently? How are other people treated differently? And have these conversations. A lot of white parents struggle to have these conversations because they grew up in white silence. Mm-hmm. But people of color, parents of color, have no problems talking about it with their kids because they talked about it when they were growing up. So you see how important it is to be talking about it when you're growing up. That's what makes the difference. So that parents of with kids at home, this is the place to do racial justice. This is where the work happens. White supremacy doesn't just automatically pass on. It is transferred in your homes. So you can do anti-racist work with your kids. It's really a beautiful redemptive thing, and hard, but beautiful.
That's so helpful. So good, Cindy. I love that. I did want to, as we talk a little bit, and I want to talk more about kind of doing anti-racist work and justice work with kids and kind of forming them that way. But kind of the dual side of that question, sort of being prompted about like technology, I did want to ask specifically about, because I know, I mean, all of us are trying to navigate those realities and, I don't know, kind of doing a deep dive in the last few years with some of Sherry Turkle's work. I mean, we kind of know that we're rewiring our brains and kind of living in a social experiment in that way where we don't know exactly where all that lands. Kind of what's your sense about kind of how in the, it, like how in a discerning way we give our kids the resources to, I don't know, like we're having a lot of these conversations right now, especially Caitlin, the 15-year-old, like with her cell phone, like, you know, to what extent access should be restricted, if at all. Obviously, she's not a fan of any restrictions at this point. But knowing, you know, so we have a lot of fun. Again, all our conversations are super open. But knowing, you know, that there are, you know, connections too between, as you say, with it, all of us adults, any of us, in terms of our technologies and depression. I would just love to hear just kind of your riff on that in terms of how we approach healthy boundaries and technology.
Yeah. Yeah, I too have teenagers in my home. I think of parent, like the kind of parenting I advocate for is really this partnership and collaboration. Mm. And so like I would work together with your child because again, each child is different. Some kids are going, it's kind of like alcohol consumption. Some people can have alcohol in moderation and enjoy it and find pleasure. And it's fine. Some people get addicted and it ruins their lives, right? And so with technology, I feel like that's similar. Some people are able to use it for fun and it's pleasurable. Some people, it eventually takes over their lives. And so depending on your kid's temperament and how they're responding to their devices and technology, you really have to work with them. And instead of giving restrictions, like I'm not a huge fan of that, I like this idea of saying, let's work together. What do you think is best for you? And if you need help with boundaries around this, how can we help support you and give you the resources? Can we help you provide another activity to do? You know, like, so you see that language and posture is more like, let's work together. Yeah. Instead of, this is going to be the rule and you need to follow it because we know what's best for you, because that's not true. We don't know what's best for our kids. Our kids know what's best for them, you know? So, yeah, I feel like that is a much better approach. And I don't know, I find that kids are open to, especially, you know, if you have this relationship of openness, they can maybe tell you, yeah, when I've been on my phone for 12 hours on social media, scrolling nonstop, it makes me feel really icky. Mm-hmm. And to kind of get to the bottom of what's troubling about too much screen time and all this stuff. So yeah, try to, you know, get to know the thing beneath the thing. What's going on? And so much of kids' behavior is like this because they don't communicate in the same way that we might communicate. They communicate through a lot of behavior. So a two-year-old won't tell you, I'm sad and lonely and anxious. They'll just throw a tantrum, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to say, okay, what's going on underneath this thing? And so many teenagers, I think, turn to technology because there's a thing beneath the thing. And I think instead of taking away a device, have a conversation about what's going on. That's deeper.
That's so great, Cindy. Get to the thing beneath the thing. And I love that. I love the idea of that kind of collaboration, which brings me to something else I wanted to ask you about, because I feel like it's connected in terms of this whole idea of kids and agency. Something else that I loved, even because I do think there's so much just gold in your Twitter feed right now. I thought this was so interesting and provocative, where the other day you were tweeting about, there was the picture of like the family who's like at a protest and kids holding up the sign that says, take your mask off because God's got you covered. And I love like I loved your whole treatment of that, you know, in terms of like knowing there'd be people who would kind of bring the accusation that it would be hypocritical. I mean, like we've certainly had the kids with us with stuff that we're doing, but like if you're going to an event where there's, you know, science is real signs or pride signs or whatever it might be. But I would love for you to say a little bit more about this idea about how not all political ideological education of kids are equal, and specifically what your critique would be of an image like that.
Yeah. So I'm all about, because I grew up in this religious environment that I felt like violated a lot of my autonomy, I'm all about building up children's autonomy. I believe in children's agency, and I believe that they are full human beings that are engaging fully with the world, that they're not pawns, they're not puppets, they're not robots that we program, right? And so I just really want to lift up and amplify children's voices and their ideas and their plans for everything, including political engagement. But the challenge is when you see pictures of kids who are holding up, wearing MAGA hats and holding up signs that are blatantly racist, or just ridiculous, like God's got you covered instead of wearing masks, something like that. And you're like, oh, well, those kids are being manipulated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what I try to say on Twitter is that you have to, again, see the thing beneath the thing. A picture is a snapshot. We don't know what's happening behind the scenes. We don't know what that child is thinking. I know that when I was a kid, that I held up signs that I would be horrified to think of holding up now. And so what happened? I changed. And so these kids have the capacity to change. And even at their age now, they could be engaging, they could be struggling and wrestling. And we don't see that in a picture. So I'm always pushing for people to see the fuller humanity of children, because there are so many ways the world tells us to flatten, to caricature children, that they're just these kids who are, oh, they're so cute. They say, you know, we diminish them. We say that they, even when it's good, when we see them holding up science as real signs, we're like, oh, this kid, this girl is such a firecracker. That's a way of diminishing as well, because she's not just a firecracker. She is learning things from her community, and she is going to engage with it, and she might disagree with it. Right? Like, we always have to complicate that narrative that children are these flat people instead of the dynamic human beings that they are. I think those kids, we need to give them more credit. But at the same time, having said that, I do also think there are environments in which children are given the space to disagree. So I feel like the people behind the kid who is holding up signs as real signs likely are giving their kids the opportunity and the space to disagree, to dissent, to push back, to form their own opinions, as opposed to people who are holding up signs that diminish people's humanity. I feel like those kids probably are not given the agency to push back and dissent. And that is sad. And that's what I hope to, fight against, that we don't treat our children in that way. I think that every kid is exposed to values where we don't live in moral vacuums. There's no parent who aren't passing on some sort of value to their kids. I don't deny that. But we can do it in a way that's thoughtful, that honors their autonomy, that allows them to engage as equal people with us. That's a huge difference between telling a child what to believe and what sign to hold up, to say, hey, again, it's the working together thing, right? Like, let's work together. Let's think about the problems of our world. Let's think about what the society is facing. And what do you think we can do? What are your ideas? And to truly solicit their ideas and imagination, and to work with them to make it, to have some sort of impact, because it's a human right to have a say in the way we live our lives. Like, that's the foundation of democracy, right? So our kids deserve that too. They are also citizens.
Yes. Yes. That's so great, Cindy. I love that. And even the way you kind of delineated between those two different energies, which I think is real, I think we can presume is at play there. They're very different energies. That's also important. I love this conversation. I love the conversation that you're facilitating right now. I love the kind of space that you're carving out for people. The last thing, I mean, there are a thousand things I want to ask you, so I just need to have you back on again. But one thing I wanted to ask for sure, because now that you have been carving out this space for a minute, and clearly there's resonance with people, and it's kind of hitting a nerve. And part of what makes it so exciting and kind of provocative to me is that, you know, this is, again, this is the book. I mean, this is kind of a resource that's so helpful for people within our own faith community. I'm just wondering now that as you go further into this and more people who are on this kind of journey that are parenting are finding each other, what are you thinking about kind of the next phase of your work? Like, what kind of needs are emerging? Are there still surprises? Are there, in terms of like, what's next for you in all of this?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I've been thinking about it myself because I also have a podcast called Parenting Forward where I talk about these things. And I've been doing it for maybe a year and a half. And I was like, is there enough content? Have I already exhausted all the conversations? And I don't feel like I have. I feel like there's still so much more to be said. And I think because ultimately the parenting conversation is the human conversation, because we're raising human beings. And so as long as the human experiment continues and climate change doesn't kill us all,
right?
I feel like there is still things to talk about what it means, excuse me, what it means to be human. I love working with children. I love talking about children because there's such a vibrant energy and imagination and hope. I hope to keep talking about these things that I hope matters.
That's wonderful, Cindy. And I love the way you keep kind of bringing that around, because I know it's, and I've laughed at myself a couple of times here because I think of all the kind of conversations I have around like theology, faith, culture. It's like, for as much as I feel like, as I feel connected to the kids and it's intuitive and it's spiritual, it's very beautiful. I feel like in terms of like any sort of, this is also in terms of this kind of conversation, the thing I feel the greenest about. And it's so reassuring to me that you always bring things around to like, now you do know children are just like, you know, they're people, they're just like smaller people, and parents also people. It's very scalable when you keep bringing this around. Like, yes. We are talking about all stages of just the human journey here.
Yeah. You know, that binary assumption is real. And, I do try to disrupt it as often as I can. It's like our children are not really all that different than who we are. So we're in this together.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Cindy. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'm so grateful for you. I'm grateful for your work. And what's the best way for people to connect with you, I guess, to the website?
Yeah, I have my website, cindywongbrandt.com, and there you'll find access to my Facebook group, Raising Children Unfundamentalist, and my podcast. And I've hosted a couple of conferences that you can still access. You should be able to find everything there.
Perfect. Well, I'm just, again, just so grateful for the conversation and just thankful again for the space that you're carving out. So important for so many of us who are on this kind of a journey, and just really appreciate the time today. It's been really beautiful.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you for joining us today on the Zeitcast with Jonathan Martin. The Zeitcast is brought to you by the generosity of our patrons. If you are enjoying this podcast, consider rating it, writing a review, or sharing with a friend. We couldn't do this without you. To learn more about Jonathan and to support this podcast, visit jonathanmartinwords.com. We would love to hear from you.